You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
In February, North Korea carried out its third nuclear test. UN sanctions and mutual accusations of hacking by North and South Korea followed. North Korea then declared that the conditions for nuclear war were being created on the Korean Peninsula. And just last week, the North moved missiles into place. How have things arrived at this crisis point? Christine Hong is an assistant professor at UC Santa Cruz. She's also a board member of the Korea Policy Institute, and she joins us now by phone from California to discuss tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Hello, Christine, and welcome back to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Oh, thanks, Mordecai.
Take us through the events over the last year or so. When did tensions begin to ratchet up?
Well, I mean, you know, we could take the long view and say that the structural basis of U.S.-North Korea relations has been war, you know, for over six decades. That's one long perspective. But more immediately, since the death of Kim Jong-il, the United States and South Korea discerning his death as a moment of weakness and vulnerability on the part of North Korea have seen fit to ratchet up and intensify war threats on the Korean Peninsula. And so, you know, in the wake of Kim Jong-il's death, the U.S. and South Korea, which routinely hold these massive annual war games, Key Resolve, Full Eagle, Old Chief Freedom Guardian, there are many of them, decided to implement a previously secret plan called O-Plan 5029. And basically this plan, you know, which involves like a sort of combination of a simulated computer sort of facilitated, you know, sort of virtual activity as well as live fire drills, simulated the invasion and regime collapse of North Korea in addition to a U.S.-ROK joint occupation of North Korea. And as you know from what Chuck Hagel and the Pentagon have recently revealed, these war games involve the simulation of a nuclear first strike against North Korea. And so, you know, in addition to this, the United States and the past year has transferred mine-resistant armored vehicles, which were used in Afghanistan and Iraq, to the DMZ. It also last year increased South Korea's ballistic missile range, giving it a special exemption so that it could strike North Korea. It announced the completion of these nuclear bunker busters for use against North Korea, and it basically transferred all of these like top military brass from Afghanistan and Iraq to lead operations in Korea. And so, you know, this is the kind of foreign policy that most of the American public doesn't really pay attention to, but North Korea very carefully observes. So what I'd say is this is the sort of underreported story that attests to joint U.S.-ROK escalation and their intensification of war as a possibility on the Korean Peninsula.
So does this mean the North Koreans, seeing what the American and South Korean maneuvers were, has concluded that it has no choice other than its nuclear program as a deterrent?
You know, yes, absolutely. You know, North Korea now states that its nuclear deterrent is foundational to its sovereignty and self-determination. And, you know, if you even go back to 2002, and of course that was the infamous year in which George W. Bush labeled North Korea as part of the Axis of Evil, but it's also when the U.S. Nuclear Posture Review targeted out North Korea alongside a number of other quote-unquote rogue states for possible nuclear first strike. And at this moment, basically North Korea issued a statement back in 2002 saying, it's clear, I mean, this is almost verbatim, that the nuclear lunatics are in the White House, and stated that its only possibility for existence was to pursue a nuclear path. And even in the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review, and this is under Obama's watch, basically, even as the United States took the possibility of a nuclear first strike off the table for all other countries in the world. It reserved the right to commit those against Iran and North Korea. So basically, you know, North Korea has a very long history of being a target of the United States. At mid-century, the United States technologically, as is the case now, outmastered North Korea in terms of its military power. And it, the United States owned the skies in this asymmetrical war, the Korean War, which is not finished, and it rained ruin over North Korea, which it regarded as a giant free fire zone. North Korea alone lost 3.5 million people, 70% of whom were civilians. And so, you know, it's really against this horrendous memory of ruin that North Korea in the years since has really elaborated its policy as one of radical self-defense.
Now, we hear a lot about the government of North Korea, certainly stereotyped. We hear very little about the government of South Korea. What do you think are the main things we should know about that government structure?
Well, I think that, one thing to realize is we have a conservative in power. You know, her name is Park Geun-hye. She has stated that, and she had to do this because her predecessor was a rabid neocon. And, you know, Obama took his cues. I mean, Obama's policy within East Asia has been extremely neoconservative. I don't think that it's surprising to your listeners, to acknowledge that Obama's policy, foreign policy, has been extremely interventionist. You know, we tend to associate that kind of policy with George W. Bush, but, you know, look at what Obama has done relative to Libya, look at the policy towards Syria, et cetera. North Korea regards these all as precedents. With regard to South Korea, up until recently, there was a neocon in power, and Obama and this neocon walked in lockstep together. And there was no engagement of North Korea. We now have another conservative in power in South Korea. But she had to moderate her foreign policy because it was viewed by the South Korean, the policy of her predecessor was viewed by the South Korean people to be a disaster. And so she has stated that she is going to have a trust politique policy with North Korea that involves some aid and some degree of dialogue and negotiations instead of just a kind of wall. And we have yet to see that realized, it's a sort of sad comment to say that one sort of faint glimmer of hope resides in her taking, I hope, a kind of sane foreign policy approach to North Korea. As I said, we have yet to see that implemented.
Has the United States or any of its allies attempted to engage diplomatically with North Korea?
You know, that's a very sad fact of the administration of a president, Barack Obama, who came into office with an inaugural promise that the United States would reach out a hand if America's historic foes would, unfurl their fists. And so, after George W. Bush, I think the American public was very prepared for a leader who would actually seek pathways of peace and coexistence with Iran, seek peace and coexistence with North Korea, and, all these other sort of areas of the world that the Bush administration demonized. What we have seen under Barack Obama is a policy toward North Korea called strategic patience by his advisors. This is commonly misunderstood by the policy world to mean a passive wait and see, do nothing kind of policy. In fact, Obama's policy of strategic patience has meant non-engagement at the same time that it has pursued a forward-deployed military posture within the region. And this, of course, is what former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta called America's pivot policy to Asia and the Pacific. And as Hillary Clinton described it, she said, you know, all the eyes of the world might be on the Middle East and the wars that the U.S. is fighting there. She said, but America's economic future resides in Asia. And, of course, America's primary economic rival is China. And she said that, you know, America, the United States, would use an existing infrastructure, a military infrastructure within the region, which Chalmers Johnson called an empire of bases, in order to assume a forward-deployed posture in order to secure America's economic future. So if you think about Obama's policy of non-engagement coupled with a very aggressive, very militaristic sort of policy that is aimed at containing China, you realize that this has been a large part of a recipe for disaster.
The Americans' roving ambassador for foreign affairs is just visiting China, or has visited China. I don't know whether he's already left. He was to meet with the Chinese foreign minister today, I believe. Do you have any news as to what's come out of that, or what the intention of the United States is in that visit?
You know, I think that it's very interesting to see the United States visiting China and seeking to find common cause with regard to North Korea. And I think we have to be very careful about how we parse the message of especially the mainstream media with regard to China's stance toward North Korea. You know, Xi Jinping recently released a statement saying that China would not tolerate troublemakers within the region that are pursuing their own selfish ends. And what was very interesting to see was that the lion's share of, you know, U.S. media assumed that the troublemaker was a thinly veiled reference to North Korea. But the Associated Press was a little bit more, I think, critical, and pointed out that it could be interpreted, that the term troublemaker could be interpreted to mean not just North Korea, but also the United States. And I think that what we have to be aware of is the fact that China has basically concentrated a good number of its military forces along the China-North Korea border, and it has also carried out a series of live fire drills in the West Sea. And so I think that the U.S., in dialing down what the Department of Defense called its playbook, which is basically a series of aggressive displays of military might that the U.S. Was staging with its ally South Korea within the region, I think that, you know, the U.S. decision to dial that back was also in part a nod to the fact that its displays were displeasing China. The last thing that China will tolerate is an overly hubristic United States within the region.
If you were designing a way to avoid war in the Korean Peninsula, what would you advocate?
You know, it's funny. There was a blueprint for precisely a peace system on the Korean Peninsula versus this war system that we've had. If you look at the 1953 Armistice Agreement, which North Korea nullified because it viewed it as only maintaining a state of war, that agreement specified that within 3 months' time, and this is signed in 1953, within 3 months' time, the signatories, China, the DPRK, and the United States should return to the negotiating table and hammer out a permanent peace agreement. It also specified that all foreign forces should be withdrawn from the Korean Peninsula so that the Korean people could decide their own fate. China withdrew almost immediately, you know, within 5 years' time. You know, we are now 60 years beyond the signing of the Armistice Agreement. The United States still stations 28,500 troops on the Korean Peninsula and operates over 100 military installations there. So I think that what a sane foreign policy would require is awareness on the part of the United States public what is being done in our name. And so I think that, you know, I think that the obvious way of moving forward is not a continued escalation of military power on all sides. This is a very, very hair-triggered, dangerous situation. The only rational way forward is something that the Obama administration has yet to try, and that's engagement.
Well, thank you very much for your insights into the conflict intensifying in the Korean Peninsula. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Mordecai.
I've been speaking with Christine Hong. She is an assistant professor in the literature department at UC Santa Cruz. She's also a board member of the Korea Policy Institute. And you can read her recent article on the situation in Korea at fpif.org.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@coopradio.org.